Chapter 21. Pirates and Slaves. This was my first trip to Africa. Very soon after I arrived, I discovered that my father and his second wife Allison had put considerable thought into planning a number of excursions to parts of Kenya they hadn't yet explored. And I don't think it was coincidental that these excursions coincided with my six-week visit at the end of 1967. I felt welcome and included. Our first out-of-town excursion was to Kenya's coastal port of Mombasa, 5 hours by road southeast of Nairobi. We headed off early in the good car, a 1966 Toyota Crown Deluxe, provided by United Nations as part of my father's package. The car was equipped with all mod cons, leather bucket seats, electric radio aerial and electric windows. I was impressed. Even though I had an Australian driver's license, I wasn't invited to drive either the Toyota or Allison's Audi whilst I was visiting. But I wasn't at all offended. On the contrary, I was delighted to be chauffeur-driven, as it offered me the opportunity to closely scrutinize my extraordinary surroundings as we glided by. To get to Mombasa, we drove through Tsavo National Park, with wildlife wandering on both sides of the two-lane road that for much of the way followed the railway line. By the time we reached Hunter's Lodge at Kiboko, our first stop, we'd ticked numerous boxes on our wildlife sighting sheet. We'd seen elephant, giraffe, zebra and lesser kudu. So, it was already a good wildlife sighting day, and we were only partway to our final destination. The restaurant at Hunter's Lodge was renowned across East Africa for an imaginative menu. As superior catering was a prerequisite for my father, who considered himself a gastronome, I was looking forward to something special. To my complete surprise, something special came out of left field and wasn't in any way related to food. As we made our way along the covered walkway to the open-air dining area, I could hear a cacophony of bird sounds that became louder and louder as we approached our table. From our vantage point, the sweeping view out across the landscape was dominated by a huge spreading thorn tree that was teeming with bird life and festooned with dangling birds' nests. It was an extraordinary sight. The tree was home to hundreds of small bright yellow and black weaver bird pairs. Their nests, in various stages of completion, firmly secured to the finer branches. I was captivated as I watched the male weaver birds chirping noisily, whilst at the same time, weaving additional lengths of fresh green grass into their nests, taking particular care around the small circular entrance. Some females were already in residence, having deemed their partner's woven house construction to their liking. But I confess I have no memory of the meal, as the weaver bird's antics demanded my full attention. After lunch, I reluctantly farewelled the noisy avians to resume our journey. But we had one more stop to make before Mombasa. Some miles down the road, we took a left turn to go north, and before long, the settlement of Malindi came into view. Malindi was another highly regarded resort area, noted for its pristine beaches and stunning views out across the Indian Ocean. Our destination was the famous Malindi Golf and Country Club, which was high on my father and Allison's list of places to visit, even though neither of them played golf. Our arrival was perfectly timed to coincide with afternoon tea, much to my father's satisfaction. We were escorted to a veranda that looked out across the ocean, and, as we waited for tea, we felt a gentle, cooling, sea breeze. The breeze was most welcome, as we were feeling the coastal heat. From our table, we could see a cerulean blue sky, with cumulus cloud formations floating above an intensely blue ocean, the blue water fading to shades of aquamarine as it came closer to lap the sandy shore. A picture of this amazing view wouldn't have been out of place in a glossy, upmarket tourist brochure. After tea, we retraced our tracks, driving south to our final destination, the Mombasa Club on Mombasa Island. The club, an imposing 2- or 3-story colonial building with a sweeping view of the harbour, provided recreation and accommodation for their elite expatriate membership. Always keen to explore, imagine my delight to find a fair dinkum 16th century fort, right next door to the club. Things were looking up. The fort Jesus built was begun by the Portuguese in 1593, to protect their profitable trade in and out of Port Mombasa. It was a huge, imposing structure with super-thick, defensive, outer walls. At intervals along the fort's upper level, there were well-placed openings for cannons, used to deter those approaching from any direction, with marauding in mind. The only way to enter the fort was to walk up the sloping sally port. Once inside, the extensive internal area was scattered with a number of restored garrison buildings, as well as the remains of others, originally used for soldiers' accommodation, ammunition, and stores. I quickly made friends with the archaeologist working at the fort. He was a nice bloke who wasn't at all fazed by the string of questions I asked each time I visited, as I was dead keen to know about every nook and cranny. He was a mine of information. He told me that Mombasa had been founded in 900 AD and became an important center for trade in spices, gold, ivory and slaves. But it wasn't until the arrival of the Portuguese in 1593 that the decision was taken to build a fort to protect their trade and traders. Over our three-day stay, I visited the site as often as I could. The archaeologist, now keenly aware of my interest, took me to see additional sites where there were excavations in progress. He explained that the excavations had exposed layers of occupation down to the final layer of builders' rubble, evidence of the fort's genesis. He also showed me bags of catalogued finds that had been uncovered in earlier excavations, the stratigraphic layers giving up fragments of the previous occupiers' lives. I tried to imagine what life would have been like for the military men living in this fortification, ready, at a moment's notice, to fight off would-be invaders. I was enjoying myself immensely. As it turned out, there were very few visitors to the fort whilst I was staying next door at the club. So, whenever I visited with more questions, I had unlimited access to the archaeologist's knowledge of the site. Before we left Mombasa to return to Nairobi, I reluctantly tore myself away from the fort, in time to do a quick spin around Mombasa's old town, to see the remaining, solidly built, Moorish buildings. The facades of which were magnificent, with tall, studded wooden doors opening into enclosed courtyards, kept cool by thick walls, built of coral and stone. This ancient building technique helps to reduce the internal temperature of buildings, in super hot climates like Mombasa's, centuries before air conditioning. After our tour, we headed back up the hill to Nairobi, in plenty of time to prepare for the start of my father's working week. Spending time with my father and Alison on our first excursion made me acutely aware that in order to make the most of my remaining weeks in Kenya, I would need to find other folk doing interesting things, who were happy to have me tag along, as I'd done with the archaeologist at Fort Jesus. I'd keep my eyes peeled for the adventurous, because I was staying in Nairobi for another month. It remained to be seen how successful I'd be. On reflection. Hunter's Lodge. Until my first weaver bird encounter, I was certain that we, Homo sapiens, were the first living creatures to develop weaving technology. Being from a family engaged in the alchemy of turning threads into fabric, it came as a huge surprise to find a bird species similarly engaged. It was mind-blowing for me to consider the probability that this species had been weaving fibers for eons before humans evolved to do likewise. Fort Jesus. Fort Jesus, named Fortaleza de Jesus de Mombuca by the Portuguese, became my refuge between meals at the Mombasa Club. I was so grateful to have somewhere to go, to give my father and Alison a break from my thinly veiled, passive-aggressive, teenage attitude. Since my late teens, I've had a continuing fascination with all things archaeological, and I'm now certain that my interest was piqued as the result of my Fort Jesus experience, way back in 1967. Comparisons. Our excursion to Mombasa Island was, for me, a hugely broadening experience. It was almost too much to take in on a single visit. As I integrated my observations, I found myself comparing the comfortable, quasi-colonial lifestyle enjoyed by expatriates like my father and Allison, living in post-independence Kenya, to that of Papua New Guinea's expatriates, many of whom were caught up in the uncertainty the push for independence was causing at this time. In 1967, independence for Papua New Guinea was some 7 years away. There, some expatriates thought to stay, in the hope that their lifestyle wouldn't be seriously affected, whereas others planned to forego their lives of comfort and return to Australia. I imagine in pre-independence Kenya, there were expatriates confronted with the same dilemma. Do we stay, or do we go? I came to the conclusion there were similarities in both countries, with expatriates watching with trepidation, as colonialism gradually morphed into independence before their eyes. In Kenya, independence from Britain came in 1963. For Papua New Guinea, independence from Australia came in 1975. Even from my egocentric, teenage perspective, I could see that my father represented the new breed of post-independence workers, doing a job that wasn't profit-driven. Nonetheless, he relished the privileged lifestyle his status allowed. Facts. Hunter's Lodge, Kiboko. The owner of the lodge, J.A. Hunter, was variously described as a tearaway, farmer, railroad guard, big game hunter, and transport agent. He was also sometimes a poacher, a game warden, writer, and hotel keeper. In his sunset years, in the 1950s and 60s, he realized the wildlife he'd so assiduously hunted now faced extinction. Instead, he began speaking out in favor of conservation. At Hunter's Lodge, he created an oasis for some 300 bird species, including weaver birds. Hunter's 180 turnaround shows that it's never too late for an attitude change. Fort Jesus was built between 1593 and 1596 on the orders of Prince Philip I of Portugal. The building covered an area of 2.5 hectares, with walls 1 meter thick at the base. Sally Port is a secure controlled entryway to a fortification or prison. The entrance was usually protected by a fixed wall on the outside, parallel to the door, which must be circumvented to enter. It may also include two sets of doors that could be barred independently to further delay enemy penetration. Port Mombasa later became a key node in the complex and far-reaching Indian Ocean trading networks, distributing ivory, millet, sesame seeds, and coconuts to India and China. Over the centuries, Mombasa's port maintained its strategic importance, possibly explaining why it changed hands so often. It passed from Portugal to Oman, then from Oman to Zanzibar, then Zanzibar to Britain, and finally, in 1963, Kenya gained independence from Britain.